deathly cold, we didn't mess around looking at menus in windows. We ducked into the first place we came to with open seats. A cowboy bar. We should have braved the cold and spent more time looking through the window before coming in. There's nothing wrong with cowboy bars. Cowboy authentic is fine. But this was cowboy kitsch. The bar stools were full-size horse saddles. You look like an idiot if you sit on them side-saddle, and you look like a bigger idiot if you straddle them. I said to Karen, I don't want to sit on a saddle bar stool. My butt is still sore from riding 107 miles on a snowmobile. Karen asked, if your butt wasn't sore, would you want to sit on a saddle bar stool? After one beer, sitting bow-legged on an oversized saddle, we plunged back into the cold. A couple of blocks later, we found a place that was more us. The restaurant was packed, but there was plenty of room at the bar. Sitting at the bar is a crapshoot because you can't always control who sits next to you. I usually try to grab the end spot. That way Karen is on one side of me and no one is on the other. Tonight was different. We threw caution to the wind and sat right in the middle of the bar, empty seats on either side. A woman in her 20s came up to the bar and sat a few stools away. She was texting intensely on her phone. Within a few minutes, three friends joined her, her boyfriend and another couple. They crowded against me. Karen was on my other side. I angled toward Karen while we talked quietly, ate nachos, and drank our beer. We were having a pleasant dinner while our four barmates got off to a quick start. The first thing they ordered was a round of shots to celebrate the end of a long day of work. They were having a good time without us, but even for me, an introvert, ignoring them seemed rude. I centered myself toward the bar, looked at the kid sitting next to me, and said hello. His name was Chad. I don't remember the others' names. Remembering one name is my daily limit. Details of Chad's life filtered through our start-and-stop conversation. He was being pulled in two directions, the party with his friends and a conversation with Karen and I. At first he talked to us as if we were his parents, respectful and guarded. We sensed his discomfort. But after a while he realized we didn't care if he was doing shots with his friends and using the F-word in every other sentence. Finally, he asked why we were in town. We told him that we'd quit our jobs almost a year ago and were visiting all the national parks. Grand Teton National Park will be our 43rd park in 9 months, I said. Chad thought that was very cool. We talked about the national parks he'd been to. He shared with us his fond memories of visiting them as a kid. The more we talked about the parks, the more impressed he was. Then he paused, stared at us for a moment with his mouth open slightly, and said, "You guys are killing it." We think, given the context, this was a compliment. I'm not sure what we're killing, but Chad's advice was to keep killing it. Whatever it is, it must be hard to kill. Karen and I exchanged more stories with Chad, talking over the racket coming from his end of the bar. When we were ready to leave, I quietly asked the bartender to put the Chad foursome's drinks on our bill. We paid and wished them well as we bundled up for the cold walk home. We were almost out the door when the bartender told Chad we picked up their tab. From across the restaurant we heard, "Matt and Karen, dude!" We went back and got hugs and high fives from our new friends. We banked a lot of karma for a small sum. Nothing kills it like a stranger picking up your bar tab. Tomorrow it's more snowshoeing in Grand Teton National Park. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 43, Grand Teton National Park. Date, February 11, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, we had every intention of spending the day in Grand Teton National Park yesterday, but the most we could do was get to the visitor center, stamp our passports, and take our picture in front of the park sign. I woke up at 2 a.m. yesterday morning with a severe headache, which didn't let up all day. I think it may have been altitude sickness. It felt exactly like what I experienced in the middle of the night at the Wuxatchie Lodge in Sequoia National Park. Jay Hole is at an elevation of 6,200 feet. Wuxatchie Lodge is at 7,200 feet. On the Sequoia trip, as soon as we drove to lower elevation, I felt better. Karen and I are still calling this an official park visit, since we made it into the park and the visitor center. We'll have to go back and visit the park properly before we wrap up our parks trip. Right now, we're on our way back home to Issaquah. Your friend, Matt.
From Karen Smith. Subject, number 44. Wind Cave National Park. Date, April 24, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, for a sparsely populated area, South Dakota has quite a few national park sites. They're all in the southwestern part of the state. There are two national parks, Wind Cave and Badlands, a national memorial, Mount Rushmore, a national monument, Jewel Cave, and a national historic site, Minuteman Missile. They also have a corn palace, which isn't a National Park Service site, but sounds like someplace I'd like to see. After spending the weekend in Denver, we started out early on our five-hour drive to Wind Cave National Park. We wanted to get there in time to reserve a spot for an afternoon cave tour before they sold out. The Park Service doesn't take advanced reservations for these tours, and we didn't know how many people might choose to spend Easter in a cave. 12 miles from the park, we passed through the charming historic town of Hot Springs. As Matt drove, I read to him from a brochure I picked up at a gas station. The town was originally called Minnikata, an Indian word meaning hot water. Like the town of Hot Springs in Arkansas, coincidentally home to a national park, this town became popular for its mineral springs, palatial hotels, and sanitariums. After the railroad built a train depot in 1891, thousands of visitors came to Hot Springs to reap the health benefits of medicinal spa treatments. They had names like medicated baths, needle baths, silver vapor, and Turkish baths. Matt made a gagging sound. He hates baths. He always says, "Why do people want to sit in a tub of their own filth? Take a shower, for God's sake." And bathing in hot springs with strangers? There isn't a bottle of hand sanitizer in the world large enough to kill that many germs. Bathing in Purell? Now that's something he might do. I continued reading aloud from the brochure. In Hot Springs, at the turn of the century, you could rent a bathing suit for an additional charge of 25 cents. Matt grabbed the brochure and flung it into the back of the car. There were few people at the visitor center when we arrived, so we signed up for the next tour, which left 30 minutes later. We took care of business and put our backpacks in the car. We weren't allowed to bring anything with us on the tour. There were a dozen other people taking the tour, including a couple of kids and a crying 2-year-old who made enough noise for 10 people. It's hard for me to think of anything Matt would like less than being stuck underground with an unruly toddler. Maybe a mineral water group bath? But we caught some good luck also. Park Ranger Don was our tour guide. Don has worked at Wind Cave for over 4 decades. He's a legend. the Michael Jordan of cave tour guides. During the summer months, park rangers lead many different cave tours, but this time of the year they only offer one, the Natural Entrance Cave Tour. It's available several times each day. This 75-minute tour goes through the middle level of the cave, where you see one of Wind Cave's wonders, a rare cave formation called boxwork. Approximately 95% of the world's discovered boxwork formations are found in Wind Cave. There are no self-guided tours in Wind Cave. The Park Service can't have people wandering aimlessly through the fifth longest and most complex cave in the world. It has 136.55 miles of explored passageways, and they are discovering an average of 4 miles of new cave every year. Our tour began at the walk-in entrance near the cave's only known natural entrance. Once we entered through the windlocked doors, we immediately descended 300 stairs. For most of the 75 minutes, we walked single file through long, narrow passageways. At times, it felt as if we were shuffling in a chain gang. When the person in front of us stopped to take a picture, we all stopped and waited. The boxwork was interesting. Thin blades of calcite projected from the walls and ceilings, forming a honeycomb pattern. But the cave was not as fascinating as Carlsbad Caverns. The cave formations, stalactites and stalagmites, that make Carlsbad Caverns so amazing, are rare in Wind Cave. Surprisingly, Matt liked Wind Cave better than Carlsbad Caverns. He said the tight, winding passageways reminded him of the slot canyons we hiked in Utah. That's one of the great things about the park. Each visitor comes away with his or her own impression. For some, Wind Cave may be their favorite park of all. When we came to the areas of the cave where the path was wide enough for all of us to stand together in a group, Don would share with us interesting facts about the history and the geology of the cave. He needed to speak loudly and repeatedly over the crying, squirming 2-year-old and some adults who were talking amongst themselves. Many were doing things he told us not to do, like stepping off the path or touching the walls. One entire family leaned against the wall of the cave to have their picture taken. Don was very patient, but I felt bad for him. He's obviously passionate about Wind Cave, and it must be discouraging when visitors don't share his enthusiasm and respect for the cave. My favorite story that Don told us was about Alvin McDonald, one of the earliest and youngest cave explorers. In 1889, at the age of 16, Alvin moved from Iowa to South Dakota with his dad, who'd been hired to oversee a mining claim. Alvin fell in love with Wind Cave and systematically explored 8 to 10 miles of passageways by candlelight, using rolled-out string to guide him back out. He kept a detailed journal in which he described the cave, his explorations, and naming the rooms and passageways. In his own words, he was the chief guide at Wind Cave, and for 3 years he shared his passion with visitors. Tragically, in 1893, Alvin died of typhoid fever at the age of 20. Some think that Alvin's spirit is still down in the dark, cool recesses of Wind Cave. Occasionally, survey teams find pieces of his string. As recently as August 2009, when explorers discovered a room in Wind Cave that they believed no one had ever seen before, they found his signature carved onto the ceiling. The signature was dated July 1893, making it the latest known signature left by Alvin McDonald in Wind Cave. Maybe there are other Alvin McDonald signatures left to be discovered. When the tour was over, we took an elevator up to the visitor center and then drove north through the park. The Black Hills region is beautiful. The park has rolling hills of mixed grass prairie and ponderosa pine forests. Making our way toward Rapid City, we drove through Custer State Park, one of the most impressive state parks we've ever seen. On the Wildlife Loop Road, we pulled off and watched the herd of buffalo roam. Custer State Park has one of the largest, if not the largest, herd of buffalo in the U.S. We never get tired of watching them. In Rapid City, we ate dinner at one of the only restaurants in the city that was open on Easter, and then called it an early evening. Tomorrow, we're visiting Badlands National Park. Your friend, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject, number 45, Badlands National Park. Date, April 25th, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, while drinking our coffee this morning, I got on the Badlands National Park website. I wanted to see what was in store for us today. I stumbled upon a story about black-footed ferrets that live in the park. I said to Karen, "It says here that the last captive black-footed ferret died in 1979, and at the time scientists believed the species to be then extinct." Karen replied, "Good." "No, not good. Why would you think that's good? Anyway, I'm not finished. The article goes on to say, in 1981, the scientific community received astonishing news. Black-footed ferrets were discovered alive and well in the wilds of Wyoming.
And you care because?
Because it's an uplifting story about how a species once thought to be extinct is making a comeback. The park website says, with high hopes and little fanfare, 36 black-footed ferrets were released in the park in 1994. Karen asked, "What is a ferret? A big weasel?" After a quick check of Wikipedia, I replied, "You are correct. It's a member of the weasel family." I continued to tell Karen about how the park is planning a ferret festival this fall, including a puppet show, I'm assuming they're ferret puppets, scientific lectures, a live ferret exhibit, and a ceremonial release of several captive ferrets back to the wild. We may have to come back for that. Karen said,
"Does it concern you that the park is pushing their weasels so hard? Is that their main attraction?"
I replied, "They're not pushing their weasels. This is just something I found on their website. They have other attractions, like buffalo and grass and eroded hillsides."
"I can't wait."
Karen's excitement level increased after the coffee did its job. It took about an hour to get from our hotel to the park border. We drove east from Rapid City along I-90 and turned south at the town of Wall, South Dakota, on Highway 240, and followed it into the park. Badlands National Park looks larger than it is because it's surrounded by the Buffalo Gap National Grassland. The park was established in 1978, and despite being so desolate, it draws a million visitors each year. The Badlands have a strange beauty that you must see in person to appreciate. The constantly changing light, the odd formations, the multicolored bands of exposed rock. We've seen this before in Death Valley, Petrified Forest, and Bryce Canyon National Parks, to name a few. These areas aren't places where you'd want to settle, build a little house, and start a new life. But they are beautiful to look at, especially at dawn and dusk. Once inside the park, we drove the Badlands Scenic Loop Road southeast to the Ben Rifle Visitor Center. The first few miles of the drive cut through the roller coaster hills of the Badlands. I was awestruck by the scenery. We stopped several times to take pictures, but it was like a cruel trick. After each shot, I would look at the photo on my camera, but I never captured the magnificence of the scene. You'll have to trust us when we say it is worth the trip to see the Badlands. For the past 500,000 years, water has eroded the hillsides in the park, revealing layers of rock and sediment that are up to 75 million years old. Besides being interesting to look at, these exposed surfaces are rich with fossils. Paleontologists have used this area as an outdoor laboratory for over a century. In 2010, a 7-year-old girl, a junior ranger no doubt, spotted a fossil sticking out of the ground and alerted a ranger. After several days of careful excavation, paleontologists removed the fossil from the surrounding rock. Later, they identified it as a 30-million-year-old saber-toothed cat skull. April is a tad early for the vacation crowd. We were fortunate to have the park almost to ourselves. We also lucked out with the weather. It's the beginning of the rainy season here, and large, puffy clouds with dark bottoms floated overhead for most of the day, but it never rained on us. Not far from the visitor center is Castle Trail. It was our hike for the day. The hike was perfect for Karen. 5 miles out to a flush toilet and 5 miles back to the car. It was an uneventful hike, the kind we like. We enjoyed being in the middle of nowhere with sweeping views of the wilderness. Karen was concerned about getting sunburned, even through the clouds. Halfway through our return hike, I looked back to see her hiking with her jacket over her head, vampire style. "I don't want the sun to make my skin look any older than it already looks," she said. "I'd rather you look old than walk around with a jacket over your head. You look like a crime boss on the way to prison." "Why do you care? There's no one out here to see me." "I can see you. It's just weird." She pulled the jacket off her head, but I'm sure she put it back on as soon as I turned around to start hiking again. On our way back to Rapid City, we drove through a long stretch of the national grassland south of the park. I'd wanted to see what a national grassland looked like. It was a large expanse of prairie grass. Nice, but we should have taken the route back through the park along Sage Creek Rim Road instead. A ranger at the visitor center told us that's where the buffalo were roaming today. Why did I choose grass over bison? No worries. I have a feeling we will be back here again to see them someday. It was too early to go to dinner when we got back to our hotel, but we went anyway. It was happy hour, and the beers were surprisingly cheap. So cheap, we thought the price was a typo. We quickly ordered, excited that we might be getting away with something. By 7 p.m., we were back in our room with hours to kill before bedtime. Between Karen and me, we had a full load of laundry to do, so, with an armful of dirty clothes, I went looking for the hotel's washing machine. An hour and a half later, as Karen was digging her clean clothes out of the warm pile on the bed, she looked at me and asked, "Where's my underwear?" I thought it might be a trick question. The happy hour beers hadn't worn off yet. "I don't know where your underwear is. I'm assuming you have a pair on."
"No, I mean, where is the underwear I gave you to wash? I gave you 3 pairs.
"They should be in the pile," I said.
"Well, they're not. Are you sure you didn't drop them on the way back from the laundry room?"
I replied, "I think I would have known if I dropped something on the way back. Please." Karen went to the door and looked in the hallway.
"There's one right there."
She ran out and grabbed the red pair before anyone walked by. The door locked behind her. I was expecting a knock right away, but several minutes passed before I heard it. I opened the door to find Karen grasping several pairs of underwear in her hands and giving me a look as if she expected an explanation. She said, "I found one in the hallway, one in the stairwell, and one neatly folded on the table in the laundry room." She stood looking at me, waiting for my response. I had nothing to say.
"Well, I can't wear the pair I found in the laundry room until it gets washed again. I can only imagine how long it was sitting on the dirty floor before someone picked it up. It was nice to have mostly clean clothes again, but we should have stayed in the park longer. Next time, maybe when we're back for the Ferret Festival, we'll hang out in the park until it's dark enough for the ranger-narrated stargazing program. We can do happy hours and laundry at home. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 46, Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Date, April 26, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, for as few cars as we saw in Theodore Roosevelt National Park today, there were a surprisingly high number of roadkill prairie dogs. The natural order of things dictates that the smaller an animal is, the quicker it needs to move when cars approach. Buffalo can stand in the middle of the road all day if they want. Squirrels need to get the hell out of the way, and fast. Prairie dogs haven't learned this lesson. As we pulled away from the pea dog town, one sat still in the middle of the road as our car went by. I expected him to move, but he didn't. We missed him by about a foot. He sat upright on his back legs, his front paws in Karen pose, and squinted his eyes when the breeze from our car hit him. The park has two units, a north and a south. Both are in western North Dakota. The south unit is about 30 miles west of the town of Dickinson. The park preserves a section of the North Dakota Badlands, which are ideal for wildlife viewing, trail riding on horseback, and hiking. Our drive today from Rapid City to the park took 4.5 hours. We used the afternoon to get the lay of the land and make a plan for tomorrow. At the Medora Visitor Center, just south of the park, we asked the ranger for hiking suggestions. We also walked through Teddy Roosevelt's Maltese Cross Cabin, which sits adjacent to the visitor center. The park is named after Roosevelt because he came to this area in the 1880s and 1890s to hunt buffalo and ranch. He sold his interest in the ranch a few years before he became president. His cabin, the one on display at the visitor center, was originally built a few miles south of Medora, but was moved many times to be displayed when T.R. became president. It spent the last 50 years where it sits today. From Medora, we went into the park and drove the 36-mile scenic loop drive. It was raining off and on, but was still a pleasant day. We saw very few other cars or visitors in the park. Early in the loop, we came to a large prairie dog town. Karen asked me, "Why are they called prairie dogs? They're not dogs, they're rodents." "Because prairie rodent sounds stupid," I said. I pulled the car to the side of the road and rolled down our windows to get a good look at the little fellas. Stretched in front of us were hundreds of acres of pea dog town, like a giant whack-a-mole game. Pea dogs have a well-tuned early warning system to alert one another of approaching danger. The dogs closest to the threat bark, wag their tails nervously, and dance in circles to let the rest of the town know something isn't right. I even saw a couple of backflips. One acted so agitated I thought it was going to faint. That's a lot of energy to put out every time a car approaches. If I were a pea dog living next to the road, I'd consider moving farther into town. With some encouragement from me, Karen agreed to let them keep their dog moniker, although I explained to her that she didn't have any official say in the matter. One of the main attractions in the park is the buffalo. In the mid-19th century, there were an estimated 60 million buffalo in America. 50 years later, there were fewer than 100. Had the federal government not aggressively intervened, there's little doubt that hunters would have killed every last one.
Ironically, Roosevelt, known as the conservation president, came to North Dakota to hunt buffalo. He was part of the problem he was crusading to fix. What could be more American? On the loop, we stopped at least a dozen times to look at buffalo by the road. The ranger told us they were starting to see newborns in the park. We saw several small buffalo, but weren't sure if they were newborns. The small ones had short horns, so we figured they must be yearlings rather than newborns. Mother buffaloes probably weren't giving birth to babies with horns, at least not more than once. Near the end of the loop, we came across yet another group of buffalo. Lying in the tall grass in the middle of the herd was a newborn. Karen said it was her dream come true. I stopped the car and rolled down the windows. We sat for a long time trying to get a picture of the baby. The angle was never good. The newborn was either facing away from us or had its head down in the grass. Finally, the newborn got up and stood next to its mother facing us. Karen shouted, "That's your money shot!" She startled the baby buffalo and me, but I was able to get at least one good picture of mother and baby before they moved away. After leaving the park, we drove to Dickinson, where we checked into our hotel room. I asked my research assistant where we were having dinner tonight. This is one of Karen's most important duties on our parks trip, researching local eateries, so we don't spend hours at the end of our long days looking for a decent place to eat. Tonight it was takeout Thai food. I wanted to go to IHOP. Karen likes it when they make silver dollar-sized pancakes for her by special request. But there's only one IHOP in the state, and it's in Fargo. We ate the Thai food in our hotel room, and I am pleased to report that Karen's record remains perfect for finding good food when we travel. Her job as a research assistant is safe. For now. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Teddy Roosevelt, continued. Date, April 27th, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, buffalo definitely have the right-of-way in the park. Anywhere, really. We had to stop our car many times to wait for them to cross the road. They may seem passive and slow-witted, but they are neither. A ranger told us that a few days ago, a visitor here at the park rolled down his car window and reached out to pet one. The buffalo climbed onto the hood of his car, crushing the windshield. He had to go to the hospital for stitches where the broken windshield had cut him. We are only visiting the south unit of the park on this trip. The ranger told us there are more buffalo in the north unit, despite it being smaller than the south unit. The buffalo in the north become so overpopulated that the park service rounds up and culls the herd every year or so. The culled buffalo are then given to Indian tribes or sold to ranchers. Several of the trails we wanted to hike today were impassable due to high streams, so we chose the upper Talkington Trail, which cut across an open plain with no water crossings. By 9:30 a.m. we were hiking the 8-mile round-trip trail. It was a great hike, sunny, 60 degrees, with beautiful panoramic views of the park's badlands. We saw wild horses and antelope, but no buffalo or other hikers. The sign-in register at the trailhead showed that the last group to hike this trail was April 12th, over 2 weeks ago. About 3 miles into our hike, the trail cut through a pea-dog town. When we passed through the town, the dogs barked and did their odd danger dances. There was a story in the park newsletter about how ranchers wiped out pea-dog towns in the olden days. They killed millions of them. Now they're protected inside the park. They're an important part of the park's ecosystem, primarily because they're a food source for other animals. When the pea-dog population decreases, it sets off a chain reaction in the ecosystem. For example, The near extinction of the black-footed ferret is due to the decrease in pea dogs, pretty much the only thing they eat. Biologists believe that a single black-footed ferret requires 100 acres of pea dog town to survive. That's a lot of pea dogs for one ferret to eat. After the hike, we ate cold leftover Thai food in our car, not recommended, and then headed out of the park. On the way out, we came across a herd of buffalo. We stopped our car in the middle of the road, and the herd slowly surrounded us as they passed by. Just as the last few were coming out of the tall grass, we noticed a baby buffalo in the group. It was the second newborn buffalo we saw in 2 days. The drive from TRNP back to Rapid City, South Dakota, is about 250 miles. I wanted to type the notes from the day on my laptop, so Karen was driving. As soon as she got on the highway, driving 75 miles per hour in the rain, Karen discovered a tick on the back of her neck. It's tick season in North Dakota. She managed to keep the car on the road, barely, while I removed it. I assured her that it was most likely the only tick we picked up while on the hike, as I removed another tick from my arm without her seeing me. She drove, twitching and squirming. She said she could feel them crawling all over her body. Karen's nickname for the rest of the afternoon was Itchy. I stopped counting after I found the sixth tick. All were embedded on the back of her neck or in her hair. By then, I'd lost credibility with Itchy when I tried to convince her that we finally got them all. About an hour into the drive, I looked up from my laptop to see Itchy trying to pass a line of four cars in a U-Haul. We were on a two-lane highway and approaching a hill that we could not see over. She made it past the U-Haul and two of the cars and then, still in the left lane, slowed way down and said, "Uh-oh, I wonder if that first car is an unmarked police car." I couldn't speak. I had to try not to pee in my pants. I shouted, "It doesn't matter now, you're in the wrong lane." Itchy floored it and made it back into the right lane just before we got to the top of the hill. I looked over at her with wide eyes. All she said was, "Good thing that wasn't the police." Just when I got the nerve to start typing again, she hit the brakes. I looked up and saw a car coming toward us in our lane. It swerved back, just missing us.
"That one wasn't my fault," she said.
5 minutes later, we came to a small town. Itchy saw a mailbox and decided it was the perfect time to pull off the road to mail her postcards. This took just long enough for the four cars and U-Haul to pass us. Right now I'm typing these notes as Itchy tries to peek around the string of slow cars. There is a hill coming up and it's still raining. She's going to try to pass them again. If you're reading this email, then either we made it without crashing, or a state trooper found my laptop and decided that since writing this was the last thing I did before I died, it was important enough to send to you. Your friend, Matt.
From Karen Smith. Subject, number 47, Congaree National Park. Date, June 19, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, we're sitting at the bar at the Lexington Avenue Brewery in downtown Asheville, North Carolina, watching the guy next to us email naked pictures of himself from his iPhone. He must be running for Congress. We drove here from South Carolina, where we've been for the last 2 days. We flew from Seattle to Charleston, and when we finally arrived at our hotel room at midnight, we got an extra special welcome. When I walked into the room and threw my stuff on the bed, I thought I saw something scurry across the floor and under the dresser. I assumed it was a mouse, since we were in a historic hotel in the old part of the city. Matt knew he'd never get any sleep unless he moved the dresser and showed me that nothing was there. So he moved the dresser and nothing was there. He said it must have been a shadow. As soon as he walked back to his side of the bed, he saw the shadow. It was a bug the size of a mouse. It's what I would call a cockroach on steroids, but what the people in South Carolina call a palmetto bug. It was too big to bludgeon, so Matt put the trash can over it upside down, pushed it out into the hallway, and went to have a conversation with the front desk. They sent the hotel maintenance man, who came in with a huge canister of bug spray and offered to fumigate our room. We declined. We decided it would be safer to sleep with the giant bugs than to breathe DDT fumes all night. We had a great time yesterday exploring Charleston. Too good of a time. After officially proclaiming this the summer of the margarita, we felt obliged to sample the margaritas at every bar we wandered into. They got progressively better as the evening wore on. It was brutal getting up at 5:45 this morning to drive to Congaree National Park, just outside Columbia. We needed to be there by 8:45 a.m. for our canoe tour in the park. On weekends throughout the year, park rangers provide a limited number of free guided canoe tours along Cedar Creek. They say it's the best way to see the park. Reservations for the canoe tours fill up very quickly, so you have to call months ahead of time to get a spot. Ranger Bill was our guide. Helping him were two enthusiastic volunteers who kept Matt and I and the other two families from tipping our canoes over or turning off down the wrong tributary, never to be seen again. The youngest child on the tour was a small 6-year-old boy, who may not grow any bigger after his grandmother sprayed his entire head and body with DEET. The water level in the creek was unusually low, but to our relief, it didn't smell bad, and it didn't seem too swamp-like. There were not many bugs, and the humidity was low. The water was so brown that it looked like the river flowing through Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. There were trees and bushes with low branches that hung over the creek. Bill warned us to steer our canoes clear of them. Snakes like to hang from the branches and could drop on us and into our canoes if we brushed against them. The canoes were the size that seat two adults, so Matt and I were in a canoe together. The tour moved so slowly that only one of us needed to row. Matt told me that I was the rudder, which meant whenever we needed to turn the canoe, I had to stick my oar in the water on the opposite side of the direction we wanted to turn. At first, when my ruddering skills were still a little rusty, things got a bit tense. I steered us into a few big logs and ran us aground once, but as soon as I got the hang of it, floating in the canoe was languid and peaceful. We, Matt, paddled past large bald cypress and water tupelo trees draped with Spanish moss. The tour was very interesting and quite beautiful for a swamp. Ranger Bill said it's not a swamp. He said it is a biologically diverse river floodplain ecosystem. Our GPS map, however, still labels the area as Congaree Swamp, even though swamp was dropped from the name when it became a national park in 2003. The canoe trip lasted 3 hours, and Ranger Bill and the volunteers said it had been a good wildlife sighting day. We saw snakes hanging from trees, a baby yellow-bellied turtle, a couple of white ibises, a blue heron, and a kingfisher. We stopped and looked at what I thought Bill said was a barn owl. Matt later corrected me, while laughing, and told me that it was a barred owl, not a barn owl. He couldn't believe I could mix up the two when they looked nothing alike. I didn't tell him that I didn't mix them up, I never knew there was such a thing as a barred owl. Anyway, how is he suddenly an owl expert? He doesn't even keep a life list of birds. When the canoe trip was over, we dragged our canoes out of the water and said our goodbyes to Ranger Bill and the volunteers. At the Harry Hampton Visitor Center, a beautiful new facility, we made sandwiches outside at the picnic tables. We finished our day in Congaree on solid ground, hiking the Weston Lake Loop, which was a great 5-mile hike through an old-growth forest. All throughout South Carolina, one thing that made a big impression on me, besides the bug, was how friendly and welcoming the people were. This morning, after we told Ranger Bill about all the parks we've been to, he asked us which park was our favorite. When we said we couldn't choose a favorite because there were so many incredible parks, he said very sincerely, "Well, after you spend the day in Congaree, I know it will be your favorite park." Very, very sweet. We're staying in Asheville tonight, and tomorrow we drive to Great Smoky Mountains National Park. That's all for now. We gotta go see what our congressman is up to. Your friend, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject, number 48, Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Date, June 20th, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, Smoky Mountains National Park has been misspelled for so long that the misspelled version is now correct. There's no E in Smoky like there is in Smoky Bear. Speaking of Smoky, as strange as it may sound, Karen and I try to spot Smoky Bear signs when we travel. I think I speak for both of us when I say that he's our favorite fictional government agency mascot. The National Park Service needs a mascot like Smoky. But I've never understood why he wears jeans, with the cuffs rolled up. He's a bear. He doesn't need jeans. And if he did, why wouldn't he wear a pair that fits? And if he does need pants, shouldn't he wear a shirt also? They need to give him a proper uniform if they're going to make him wear clothes. He has a nice hat, though. Smokey works for the National Forest Service, not the National Park Service, so we'll save the Smokey Bear discussion for another time. The North Carolina-Tennessee border splits the park in half at a southwest-to-northeast diagonal. We entered from the North Carolina side, stopped at the Oconaluftee Visitor Center, and then drove the newfound Gap Road through the park. When I think of mountains, I think of ranges in the western United States, the Rockies, the Cascades, the Sierra Nevadas. I was surprised then at the elevation gains as we drove west through the park. At its highest point, the newfound Gap, the elevation of the road was over 5,000 feet. It was there we took a detour onto Klingman's Dome Road. A couple of miles south on the road, we parked to do some hiking. We followed the road prong trail into the forest for 2 to 3 miles, but were forced to turn around when the trail merged with the stream and became impassable. Back at the car, we still had time and energy, so we hiked a few miles of the Appalachian Trail. The AT runs parallel to Klingman's Dome Road. It was a pleasant afternoon of hiking, a good break from riding in the car for so long. While hiking on the AT, we ran into a couple of 20-something-year-old guys who looked like they might be through hikers. We stopped and talked with them. When I asked if they were enjoying their hike, they hemmed and hawed. "It's been raining a lot lately," one of them said. "We're just happy to be dry." Their response wasn't making me wish we were on a walk in the woods from Georgia to Maine. They looked hungry and desperate. I was holding a half-eaten Snickers while we were talking with them. They both kept shifting their focus from my eyes to the Snickers in my hand. I'm pretty sure if they hadn't been worn out from days of hiking in the rain, they would have killed me for it and made Karen carry their packs for them the next 1,800 miles. It came back to me why you shouldn't talk to strangers in the wilderness. I covered the remainder of the Snickers with my hand and placed it in my pocket as Karen and I politely ended our conversation and slowly backed away. Our bear attack avoidance training was kicking in. If they started to follow us, my plan was to throw the half-eaten Snickers and the bag of Cheez-Its from the side pocket of my backpack on the ground to buy us a few extra seconds while we ran. But it never came to that. We arrived safely at our car and were truly surprised that we hadn't heard dueling banjos through the trees. We hiked enough for one day, so we drove down the other side of the divide to the town of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, where we're spending the next couple of nights. Driving out of the treed, calm, and utterly pleasant national park into the town of Gatlinburg is a shock you can't prepare for. Gatlinburg is, well, damn. Much like the Grand Canyon, my description won't do it justice. I can only describe small bits, hoping you'll get a sense of it. It's a funnel cake, arcade, fudge shop, souvenir shot glass-encrusted strip mall. Across from our hotel, local schoolgirls, wearing way too much makeup, were performing a clogging routine to very loud Dolly Parton music. The restaurant next door had a talking, animatronic hillbilly bear welcoming guests and passers-by. We actually heard dueling banjos. It concerned me that Karen didn't hate it. I kept waiting for her complaints, but they never came. She was in a daze by how over-the-top it was. My concern grew when she said, "Oh, look, a rock shop!" I would have liked to explore the town, but we needed to do laundry first. Our hotel didn't have washing machines, but their sister property across the parking lot did. We took our laundry to the other hotel, started our load, and went into the lobby. We had time to kill, which turned out to be a bonus because it was happy hour at the lobby bar, and they made a killer margarita. It was meant to be. After doing our laundry, we found a nice pizza place down the street, and then called it an early night. Tomorrow we plan on hiking to the top of Mount LeConte inside the park. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Smoky Mountains Continued. Date, July 21st, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, it was a beautiful day for a hike in the park. We got an early start and drove half an hour south from Gatlinburg on Newfound Gap Road to the parking area for the Alum Cave Trail. From there, we hiked to the top of Mount LeConte, an 11-mile round trip. The hike was fairly easy until we got close to the top of the mountain. The elevation gain for the first 4.5 miles was 1,200 feet, but the gain for the final mile was an additional 1,200 feet. It felt good to get the exercise. Just below the summit, we ate lunch at a picnic table near the LeConte Lodge, elevation 6,360 feet. The lodge sits a couple of hundred vertical feet below the peak of Mount LeConte and has spectacular views of the Smoky Mountains to the north and west. The lodge provides cabins and meals for overnight guests, but the only way to get there is to hike. There are no roads to the lodge. Pack animals carry all the supplies up the mountain that the lodge needs. They also carry trash and dirty laundry back down the mountain on their return trip. In the past, the lodge used horses for this chore, but horses tore up the trail and weren't always sure-footed enough to make it up the mountain safely. In 1986, they switched from horses to llamas. Now, a llama train, about 8 llamas at a time, bring supplies 3 times a week when the camp is open from late March to late November. Llamas can carry 30% of their body weight up the steep mountain trail and have a lower impact on the trail than horses. Llamas are also more mountain savvy. They can navigate the steep trail more easily than horses. Once they make it to the lodge, The crew unloads the llama's saddlebags and rewards them with a lunch of pancakes. We didn't see the llamas today, but I found an interesting video about them on the Great Smoky Mountains Association's website. By the time we got back to Gatlinburg, it was late afternoon, a perfect time to do laundry. The fact that it was happy hour again at the hotel across the street had nothing to do with our decision to do laundry a second day in a row. At the bar, we met a young couple. They looked to be in their 20s, from Ann Arbor, Michigan. They reminded us of ourselves at that age. They told us that they drove here from Michigan and were in Gatlinburg on vacation for a week. I asked if they were here to visit the national park. They said no. Their plan was to spend most of their time in Gatlinburg. Really? A week of Bubba Gump Shrimp Company and Ripley's Believe It or Not? We didn't want to sound like their parents and tell them what they were missing, but we purposefully talked about how great our hike was today and how beautiful the drive through the park is. Hopefully they will wander into the park this week and see for themselves. After laundry happy hour, we went to the Smoky Mountain Brewery for an early dinner. There were more people in the bar area than we expected there would be. It was trivia contest night. We were just in time to get the last two-seat table. I usually don't like audience participation activities, but we decided to play anyway. It was better than our other choice, which was to wander through town and fight the crowds for a table at Flapjack's Pancake Cabin or Hungry Bear Barbecue. We suck at trivia. The MC felt sorry for us and gave us credit for wrong answers. The answer is Amy Winehouse, but I will also accept Amy Whitehorse from the Seattle couple sitting here to my left. We didn't win or even finish in the top three, but the MC told us that we were very competitive for a team of two. Tomorrow is a travel day. We're driving to Horse Cave, Kentucky, where we're spending the night so we can visit Mammoth Cave National Park the next day. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 49, Mammoth Cave National Park. Date, June 23rd, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, on our way into the park yesterday, I saw an animal that looked like a huge house cat with no tail. It was 20 feet from the road. We pulled the car over and watched it for a few minutes before it walked into the forest. The ranger at the visitor center said it was probably a bobcat, and that very few visitors had ever reported seeing one in the park. I kept telling Karen that there's interesting stuff on the surface at these cave parks. It's not always about what's in the hole. I tried to convince her to skip the cave tour so we could hike in the park instead. Maybe we'd see another bobcat. My suggestion didn't slow her down as she marched to the ticket window to get our tickets for the Grand Avenue Cave Tour. The Grand Avenue Cave Tour is not recommended for visitors who have heart or respiratory illnesses, diabetes, or walking difficulties. The park's write-up of the tour says it's physically strenuous. We chose this tour, hoping the description would weed out the slow walkers. The tour covers 4 miles of underground passages and lasts 4.5 hours. About 65 people showed up for our tour. There was a short orientation talk at the visitor